Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good morning, and thank you very much for being here.
All engines are started.
That looks really good.
So we'd like it to stir up your cryo tank.
Oh, wow, it's going up so slowly.
The state of the space flyer during the flight is being observed with the help of radio, telemetry, and television devices.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Welcome to Space Boffins in partnership with the Naked Scientists. I'm Richard Hollingham, and for World Space Week, we've come to the European Space Research and Technology Centre, ESTEC, in the Netherlands for their annual open day.
And it's rather brilliant. The sun has come out. I'm Sue Nelson, and we're at the moment outside the main building, where inside you've got all manner of efforts to publicise European space. You've got the space scientists themselves. I've already spotted several that are involved in quite a few missions, directly explaining what they do to several thousand visitors. In fact, I think in total they're going to be about 7,000 today.
Yeah, possibly more than that. Only 5,000 let in at any one time, most of whom seem to be walking past us right now outside the centre. So coming up, we have two astronauts, including NASA's Michael Foale and his efforts to save the International Space Station. We'll also be talking to a stormtrooper masquerading as a senior European space scientist. First, we'll hear from the head of ESTEC and also director of technology for ESA, Franco Ongaro.
What we do it for the citizens of Europe. And I think it's their right to be able to see what we do and come in and touch it and see it and understand it. I love science fiction, but it's good to give the public the idea of what is true and what is science fiction.
Is that why you had some stormtroopers?
Yeah, that exactly. I'm always perplexed, but I know the kids love it, so it's fine. On the other hand, I think they see then the difference between that and what we do for exclusively peaceful purposes, let's not forget. We are 2,700 working here. And our families, we can never talk to them about what we do because they're bored stiff after listening to us for years. So for my colleagues to be able to have one day when they speak to people who are really interested in what they say and see the kids really excited, we get back the magic of what working in space is for all of us. Why, as kids, we wanted absolutely to work for ESA.
You're right about the boredom thing. A couple of days ago, I went to interview an astronaut, an Apollo astronaut, and I said to our 17-year-old son, I'm off to interview an astronaut. He just went, what, another one? It's exactly right. Give us an idea then what spacecraft are going through here at the moment. What are you working on right now?
On Friday next week, we launch Sentinel-5B, which went through here. We are working on the repeated series of the Sentinels, which are already on orbit, so the B, C, and D versions.
So these are Earth observation
satellites. Earth observation satellites, and we call them Sentinels because they're really meant to look at the health of the planet. We just sent out the last four of the first batch of the Galileo satellites, which will be launched from Guyana. They were tested here. And we're working on the next generation, the next batches.
So they're your navigation satellites?
They are our navigation satellites. I'm sorry, you're right to remind me. Thanks a million. We have three or four very exciting telecommunication ideas coming up and satellites to go with them. Quantum technologies in space, light communications, and very advanced, flexible telecom satellites, which we do to foster the competitiveness of industry. And then, of course, we have our science program. So we're just finishing packing up Baby Colombo. We'd go to Mercury, and we'll leave our testing center around March, I think. And we're working on Plato, who will deep look for planets which are habitable around the star, Euclid, which will try and probe what dark matter it really is, because we don't know about 87% of the universe, which is a little disappointing if you live in it. We are working, of course, on JUICE, which would do the grand tour.
Jupiter's icy moon.
Yeah,
Looking forward to that one. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Are you bothered about the name of JUICE? That always bothers me. JUICE is it's a bit of a rubbish name, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I think I've personally always gone for female names in my program. So Aurora, Iris. I'm always a little bit skeptical about acronyms. But hey, it's a beautiful mission. So I'll go with it.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to be with Claudie Enuret, who is the first French woman in space and also the first European woman on the space station. I mean, that's a tremendous achievement. What are your sort of greatest memories of your trips into space?
Oh, it's difficult in a few minutes to tell something like that. It was really a great adventure. I would say not just a scientific adventure, technological adventure, but truly a human adventure. For me, my first memory of that was July 69. I was 12 years old, and the landing of the first human on the moon's surface. It was something really big. And when I had my first look through the window in the space station, I saw for the first time an aurora. So, and this vision of the planet, so beautiful and so isolated also in this cosmos, but with the magic of the aurora, was something completely non-ordinary, extraterrestrial feeling. And then the feeling of microgravity floating. I am a medical doctor, so for me, a rheumatologist. It means that for me, it's very important to try to understand, to feel the sensation of the body. So it was just a dream to be there in microgravity, to do experiment and to feel and to express that for you too.
I mean, that's a huge advantage of having mission specialists, people with scientific backgrounds and not as well as the sort of, you know, test pilot, military side of things. Yeah. Do you feel that the future with space travel is going to be continuing that route, or with space tourism it's going to open it up to more ordinary human beings like myself?
I think there is, for the time being, a real transformation, a real change in space, and it's opening to private interest, private adventures, and maybe in this, I would say, in 10 or 20 years from now, we'll have more access for everyone in space. We have to think where we will go beyond low Earth orbit. For 50 years now, we are in low Earth orbit. So there was this trip to the moon, but it was already a long time ago. And now we think where we go with human crews. So Mars, for sure, Mars is a destination, is an objective, because there is there the search for life and really some very important question. But I think in between, there is this step to be around the moon and back to the surface of the moon. For me, that means that we will not only explore, to visit, but we will inhabit on the lunar surface.
Because you're back working at the European Space Agency.
Yes,
now.
I'm back in the European Space Agency and promoting this idea pushed by the Director General of
His Moon Village. Yes.
With the Moon Village. And I think really that's an interesting concept.
I agree. I love
it. It's really inspiring, that's innovative, because we have to think out of the box in order to do that. That's a global concept, a humanist one, I would say, with a lot of scientific, technological developments that will help our Earth and will help us to go further in the exploration.
Now, when we last met, it was very, very briefly. It was in the reception of the European Space Agency headquarters in Paris, and I was with Wally Funk, who's a Mercury 13 member. And obviously, Jan Werner was a big fan
of Wally, and there you both were, two trailblazers in your own right, both women involved in space in some way. Do you think, since you went into space as the first woman, European woman on the space station, do you think things have changed for women today, or are there still some issues in terms of how women astronauts are treated compared to men?
Yeah, I think it's not a problem of how women astronauts are treated. We have still a problem of candidacy, confidence to be the part of a crew. When I have been selected, it was 35 years ago, there were 10% of female candidates in the world election. And in the last selection of the European Space Agency, that means 10 years ago, 10%. No progression in the application to this job. So this is really an issue. That means not just for space, that's the same for digital world, for engineering, for hard sciences. So we have still to be motivated, determined, in order to go to this kind of equilibrium, I would say diversity, not purely parity, but diversity, because for the future we need to think and to act as a diverse society for the future. So I'm really proud to be a part of this female adventure in space. And I would say that we have great example of female astronauts that have been commander of the shuttle, commander of the space station. Peggy Whitson was there a few weeks ago, and she's really great. So we have wonderful examples.
Good role models, yeah.
Good role models. And I think we have to transmit, to explain, to share, to be there, and to be closest as possible to the question, the curiosity, to share the feeling, because as it has been said already, even if with probes, the automatic probes, we can do a lot and discover and explore the solar system, you will not have a satellite saying, "Wow, it's full of stars."
any dreams to go back, or are you firmly on the ground from now on?
I'm on the ground. I prepare for the next generation, and I hope I can contribute to the building of a village on the moon.
So do I. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you ever wanted a reason to come to one of these open days, well, this is it. This is the test area at ESTEC. And we're always told that, you know, NASA does all this stuff bigger and better. This is big, and this is, I mean, it's huge.
You were going to say better then, but you just don't know. But it is fantastic. We're in front of the Hertz radio frequency test chamber, and it's an extraordinary room filled with acoustic foam, but they're almost pyramids, like tall little pyramids, on the walls, on the floors, and they're all blue. So it's almost like a sculpture.
It's the weirdest room, really odd room, but it's at least, I would say, two stories high, almost the size of a tennis court, something like that.
It is amazing, and fairly appropriately, considering we're in the Netherlands, the structure on top of almost a wedding tier of these foam tall pyramids is what looks like a windmill. I have no idea what it is, but that's what it looks like. And I rather like the one behind it as well, which is the LEAF, the acoustic facility. That's pretty cool as well.
So this is where they test the satellites, they bake the satellites with a vacuum chamber, there's an oven here, and this is where all the spacecraft come before they're packed up and head off to launch.
Well, I never expected to be talking to a stormtrooper, at least not at the European Space Agency anyway, especially when that stormtrooper is, in fact, Matt Taylor, well known to everybody as the project scientist for the Rosetta mission. Matt, you've taken off your helmet, thankfully.
Yes.
It's nice to see the glasses and the beard above a white, quite squeaky stormtrooper outfit. Why are you wearing this?
I ask myself that when it gets too warm, because now the sun's come out, it's actually quite horrible. It is very warm. It's the ESTEC Open Day. We invite everyone to come in and see what we're doing. Last year and the year before, I gave a Rosetta talk to the public. I didn't think I was going to do that, but I thought it was a good idea because there'd been a bit of PR activity because I wore this outfit at work, you know, like you do. And they suddenly started saying, oh, we'll advertise that as kind of part of the open day. And I thought, well, I'll get part of the costume club, the Dutch garrison, the part of the 501st garrison. These are is a charity organisation that dress up in the authentic gear, as, you know, and it takes a lot of effort and money to do this. And I'm a member of that club now. Actually, there's a story there with respect to Rosetta, but I won't go into it. But bottom line is, we got the Dutch garrison to come in, and I was coming as one of them. I was coming as a Dutch garrison, but then I also gave this talk. And frankly, putting this on and taking it off is not that easy. So
we don't want to be there for that. Because this outfit, we've talked about this. I've talked about this with you before. It's got some authenticity to it. This is not just any old Stormtrooper outfit.
Yeah, there's one particular company in the UK up near Manchester, RS Props. They have a lineage to the original armour. So this has got bumps and wiggles that are originally on one of the New Hope armour sets. So that's why, you know, it's kind of the authentic one. And why it's actually really uncomfortable, because it was designed to be worn for 20 minutes shooting or something like that, not walking around. So, yeah, I know why we lost against the rebels now.
just so you're aware, I have already put on social media that Issa is building a Death Star because of all this.
Yeah, well, this is it. And then I showed in my talk an Imperial cruiser parked off the beach floating above the North Sea, just for scale.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned about, you know, Rosetta sort of coming back into the fore, because I was quite surprised, because I'd done a piece a few months ago about the new last picture of Rosetta, and then I think, oh, there's a bloody another one.
No, that is the last image. It's just it's taken a bit of persuasion to actually get it out properly. You know how it is. That's the camera team's data. Yeah. So they're a bit reticent to let this out. So in the end, we said, look, if you're going to put it out on the anniversary of the end of the mission. So, yeah, it's the same one that you saw and you spoke to Holger about on his wall. It's the same one. It's just that we now have officially released it via our comms channels.
It's more. It's just as well I didn't blab that.
No. That's the thing. And it does say in the ESA release, it says as seen here, and it points at the piece that you did.
That's
it. Because I had to make this explanation to a couple of people, even that somebody asked the question, so what was your surprise? Well, I wasn't really that surprised.
So it wasn't sort of down the back of the sofa or something. It wasn't exactly a bit of odd data.
It came across like that, but then when you read through and it refers to Sue's piece and you think, okay, yeah, it's been at least since May, and it was shortly afterwards they knew. They're like, and you see some of the videos at the end of mission, they're kind of scratching their heads and looking a bit, hang on a minute, have we got anything more?
What can you get then from these last images? Are you getting any actual science from them?
All of it's science. I mean, this is somehow the issue with respect to outreach and PR and give us your pictures. But that's that instrument team science as well. So they, you know, they look at the high-resolution images. As I show some of the stuff from Rolis when we descended with Philae, you're counting boulders. You're looking at how those boulders are formed, and that's heavy science that we're doing with the camera team.
So are you still heavily involved in Rosetta at the moment, or are you moving on to your next mission?
I'm only involved in Rosetta still. We're waiting, because I work for the science director at the European Space Agency, we wait for the next mission to be proposed. Now, there are a number of missions being studied, and if one gets down selected in the area that I appear to have some expertise, whatever that is, apart from wearing plastic and squeaking, then I might get assigned that. But at the moment, I'm just on Rosetta, and the intensity's dropped off, but there's still stuff going on. We're archiving the data. Next week I go to Spain, to Madrid. We're doing an archive review to make sure the data's in good shape for the archive. And still doing Rosetta talks, which I'm surprised about, actually. I didn't think I was going to do this today. And I kind of just, yeah, as I said earlier, I was just going to come like this and say, I'll do Rosetta, go on. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice opener, maybe, for the day.
Yeah.
Is there some advantage in having missions that are almost like our avatars out there, that go somewhere, that visit something, as opposed to missions, you know, telescope missions? Do they think that they capture people's imagination more?
I don't know. I mean, look, Hubble captures people, and that's not that far away from us. But there is, you basically, to do certain science, you have to go to certain places. So, yeah, you can't do some of the science. Look, when I show these presentations, you look at what Rosetta showed. We couldn't have got that. We didn't get that from being on the ground. So you have to go to places. Now, Rosetta, I still think, is very special in any mission in that it has this massive story arc. And I described this to people in my talk about how, yeah, because I highlighted the efforts in communication with this mission in terms of outreach. It
You're
had
saying that dressed as a stormtrooper.
Yeah. Anyway, just don't tell LucasArts or Lucasfilms. We had fantastic ingredients with Rosetta. The mission, you know, some people argue it could have sold itself because it was so good. No, it provided very good ingredients to make something more. So, you know, it's fine cuisine is what the output that yourselves, of course, are involved in, that made it more than the sum of its parts. But for me, Rosetta is very unique, though. That's the thing. There's nothing like it. I mean, we have some fantastic missions that are going to be that are discussed here today. You can go and talk to people, Gaia from BepI, but... Yeah, they just haven't got that adventure aspect, that story, that going somewhere.
They
and
haven't
there
got
was
you.
All of that.
They haven't got
that
you.
That has nothing to do with me. This is it. I am a tiny piece in this machine. Yeah. Rosetta had a really good story, and I'm lucky enough that I get to tell it even dressed
right.
like this.
It's a great team. It is a great team.
I mean, is there there's so much science, obviously, and we've talked to you about a lot of the science. Can you say it's raised more questions than it's answered? Because it hasn't had those easy answers that maybe you were hoping for. You look at that back at that ambition film, all that talk about water, and we're going to answer questions about water on Earth.
There were some high-level questions, and that's what you allude to at the beginning, or we did. So when we had the first results, we're like, we've shown this and we've shown that, it looks like this, that's what might be, or the activity is driven here. Now we're starting to dig in further. Some of the data some of the analysis that first came out, we've redone, we've compared with other instruments, and you have to refine what your understanding is. Certainly some of the molecules that we detected, we said, well, is it likely that that's there? Because it's very difficult to get some of these signatures out until you make models, you make assumptions, and when you've got more data, you can refine that. And that's what's happening now, in particular, combinations of data, looking at different instruments to address the questions. Now, your first question, have we got more questions? Yes, basically. Or it's more the first question has to be set with subset questions, and are we addressing it? Activity, what drives activity? It's still a big question. What is it that causes all this stuff to flow off? It's not simply, with some ice, it's sublimating, because that doesn't work. We've seen things change on the surface of the comet that you can't explain by just ice melting effectively. Something else has to be going on. And then these outbursts, how are they driven? The fact, one of the things that we're discussing is we saw as we came in, the comet was pretty red, dusty. It lost the dust cover, became more icy from a global perspective. Then when it moved away from the sun, it became dusty again. But the comparison between the inbound and outbound, it's redder on the way out. So the suggestion is there's an annual evolution in dust coverage as well, that you might actually find activity continuing. Something has to be going on. It's not just around perihelion. Other stuff's going on, changing the ices around, doing stuff with the surface and the subsurface for it to then come round again and behave like it has. And, there's more questions.
Thank you very much.
So you look so uncomfortable and how you really act.
I think we'll let you have a shower.
Well, I'm back on station now.
Oh,
I'll be
brilliant.
Trooping again. Yeah, and I think I just need to go and get a bite to eat and see where my blaster's gone.
Matt Taylor, a Rosetta project scientist and part-time stormtrooper on patrol here at ESTEC in the Netherlands.
This is the Space Boffins podcast, and we're in partnership with the Naked Scientists. And in a moment, we'll be hearing from British-born NASA astronaut Michael Thole. Hello, Georgia here with a quick interruption to ask for your help. At the Naked Scientists, we're always trying to make the best possible programmes. And one way we try to improve is by asking you to tell us what you think. The things we're doing well, the things we're doing not so well, and things you think we should be doing but we aren't. We've got a very simple online survey that just takes a few minutes to complete. It's open for the next few weeks, and to sweeten the deal, if you fill it in for us, you could win some Amazon vouchers. The survey is open now at www.thenakedscientist.com/survey. It just takes 5 minutes and is really appreciated. We read every word. Thank you so much. Now, back to the show.
You can see pictures of our day at ESTEC and our guests on our Facebook, Twitter, and if we can remember the login, our Instagram feeds. And just a quick mention to the Corvallis Appreciation Society. I just want to say hello to Erin in Corvallis, and thanks very much for your lovely comments on email.
Excuse me, we're from Space Boffins podcast. We're just asking people where they've come from and if they've enjoyed the day.
Okay, well, we just arrived.
Are you local? Do you live in Holland?
Yes, I live in Utrecht, but I'm actually from Germany.
So have you ever been to one of these before?
No, actually, this is the first time, but she really wanted to go because she's working at NICAP, so she's in the field.
Oh, yeah, I'm a physicist. I work in gravitational wave science.
Oh, just won the Nobel Prize?
Kind of, yes.
Not you personally, obviously.
No, unfortunately, not yet.
So for you, what does this give you the opportunity to do and see?
Well, for me, it's the first time to see. So a lot of important developments and technology happened here at ESTEC, satellite testing, and I find that really exciting because I'm also in instrument science. And it's really exciting to see these cutting-edge technologies, how they're developed and tested here. I like that a lot.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, we came and we saw André Kuipers. And now we are collecting posters and we are enjoying ourselves, yes. Yeah.
Now, from your accent, you sound like you're from the Netherlands. And yes. The fact that you saw André Kuipers, he's a well-known Dutch astronaut.
Yeah.
Was that the big attraction for you today?
No, just in general, just to see and visit the building and the site and everything. So, yeah. No, I wasn't even aware that André Kuipers was here. So.
That's good. And have you enjoyed it? Has it been good? Yes, yeah, it's good fun. Thank you very much indeed.
My name's Caroline Garrity, and I'm actually from Northern Ireland. We do STEM outreach work for it's an organisation called the Mars Generation, and we also do pieces for Astronomy Ireland magazine as well.
Now, you brought your son with you, who's dressed in a rather fetching blue flight suit, and it's specifically Tim Peake's flight suit. Why is that?
Hayden is actually on the autistic spectrum, and he was completely non-verbal until Tim Peake's launch, which was the 15th of December 2015. And Hayden watched Tim Peake's launch on TV. From then, it broke a silence. He started speaking, and his love of space has just developed, and it's just taken him into a completely different world.
The use of space then has been a tremendous help for him.
For his development, his learning, his speech, it's just captivated him. His confidence, his attention span, his learning. From not just the Tim Peake now, he's actually getting into learning about different missions, you know, Rosetta, the Cassini, all the different planets. And his big thing he's really into, because we're involved with the Mars Generation, is he wants to be the first autistic astronaut to get to Mars.
Excuse me, Hayden. I hear you'd like to become an astronaut, is that true?
Yeah.
How old are you now?
7.
So what is it about astronauts that you like? How many have you met?
I met 8.
Who was your favourite?
All of them.
We're now in a nice quiet room with astronaut Michael Foal, British-born NASA astronaut. Remind us how many times you've flown in space, because I put my notes over there and I've lost count.
I've flown in space 6 times, very, 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 very lucky. Most astronauts are very jealous of me, which is why I probably won't get to fly in space again. And I've been in space more than a year.
That's astonishing. And what's amazing for me is that I used to report on your missions for the BBC, and particularly when you were busy trying to stick your finger in holes of Mir, but not literally, but sort of basically try and repair space stations and what have you. Do you ever wake up in a cold sweat at night about those times?
No, never a cold sweat, honestly. Actually, the Mir flight, although it had many of the most dangerous events in my career occur on it, including the collision and the loss of pressure in the module, and then the loss of control of the station and the loss of electrical power. Nonetheless, because we weren't really, I didn't feel our lives were threatened for much longer than 10 seconds or so during the actual moment of the collision. After that, I always felt there was an opportunity to save ourselves. And that knowledge basically always meant that I didn't need to panic, didn't need to be afraid. And so it became actually one of my best missions, I would say, because I had so many opportunities to invent solutions to problems that ordinarily NASA managers don't expect you to try and solve.
Do you think Mir was misrepresented by the media at the time? Because it became almost this media joke, didn't it?
Flying larder, I think it was referred to quite a lot in the print press.
I was not aware of the print media, or any media, actually, during the events on Mir in 1997, when I was there for five months. I felt that I knew that something bad had happened. I was dealing with it. I only had 10 minutes of communications a day with American English-speaking controllers. And most of my news was coming from the Russian control center, which was very operational and specific to solving our problems. I was aware through radio ham calls that I was making around the world that, yes, there was a media buzz going on. And only after landing did I really hear some of the stories that were recounted or took place in the Russian control center. We call it SUP in Moscow, and indeed also in the American Congress. And there were a couple of times when I got letters from NASA saying, well, could you say this, please, and please say this, this, and this, and this, if you feel that way about it, supporting the program to keep it going, because we are now testifying in Congress to say why we should be doing this. And so I then became aware, oh, this is serious.
It's interesting as well that the difference between contact with astronauts as when you first, you know, started going up into space, and now when it feels as if, you know, every astronaut has their own Twitter account, it seems much more, well, less private in a way in terms of what an astronaut goes through now compared to just 20 years ago.
Well, I certainly had to shift my my behavior and expectations. On the Mir space station, as I said, there was 10 minutes a day. We didn't have downlink TV. And I was basically very private and cut off from the world. In fact, sometimes felt very isolated. Whereas on the International Space Station, my last flight, there's just two of us because it was right after the Columbia accident, I was being asked often to put on a TV just to watch myself. And it's like, why? And so then, you know, you become self-conscious and you don't want to scratch, you know, as spontaneously as one would otherwise. You don't want to, you know, if you're sneezing or whatever. So all those things I found a bit odd, because almost invasive. And email, of course, was the new thing for me after Mir. And that took up so much time, just keeping in touch with family and friends, as well as work, that it took away some of the fun of being in space where you have time to look out the window. Today, doing Twitter accounts, waiting for a slow internet connection, that has got to be very frustrating.
You, I think, put quite a lot of effort during those Mir days and the Shuttle Mir program into integrating with the Russians and to make it a successful program. But you mentioned it was isolating. I mean, how much effort was there to try and pull the US program together and the Russian program together?
There was no, you know, cosmic or, you know, big picture plan to pull us together when you were talking about the Russians and the Americans. But I certainly, as a crew member, feeling like I was a foreigner to the Russian station, knew that the only way I was going to survive this emotionally and psychologically was to try and join in with that crew. I knew they didn't speak English at all. I didn't know them well. I'd only trained a couple of days with them before I flew. And as a result, I made a massive effort, which has been recounted elsewhere, to try and let them allow me to run the Russian communications with the Russian control center. My Russian wasn't great, but it was better than the other American partners I had. And as a result of that, it built up some trust, not so much which was already there with my crew members, but with the Russian control center flight controllers. And then, luckily, I had started that attempt to run the what we called packet radio comm, which was a way of getting emails up and down, a very, very crude way at 1,200 baud. But luckily, I had been doing that when we had the events of the collision in 1997. And as I then suggested solutions to our problems, the Russian ground controllers were more receptive to them. And my crewmates, in particular, when we had no communications with the ground, were willing to go along with it.
It seems as well that
benefits, isn't it? So the whole point of, you know, being pulled together, it does have big benefits because it means you can respond much better to emergencies.
Tim Peake has always said that if learning Russian, he finds, is probably the most difficult part of his astronaut training. But it's obviously an investment that is rewarding, particularly now when the Americans are dependent on the Russians to get back from the space station.
One of the most positive things, and I can think of some negative things about the cooperation with Russia. One of the most positive things, probably the most positive thing about it, is the redundancy in space transportation to the ISS. This huge investment by all these countries, up to, you know, 50, 100 billion, I don't know who counts it, but it's an awful lot of money, an awful lot of work by all these 18 different countries. And when the Space Shuttle Columbia had its accident and eventually led to the grounding of the space shuttle, it left the United States with only the Soyuz rocket to carry all astronauts and cosmonauts to the International Space Station. The Russians, in almost every other sphere of cooperation or competition with the United States, will take advantage of it and put the United States in a bad position. They never did that with the Soyuz. They only cooperated. They only helped. They made nothing difficult for the U.S. And it's that cooperation, that strength in having the partnership that is really the value I think we find on the on the surface of the Earth from a project like the International Space Station.
Do you think that cooperation can continue, particularly when you have these new U.S. means of getting to the space station, the SpaceX or the Boeing capsule?
I think the cooperation between nations is somewhat at risk because of the now independent and redundant, in a good way, space transportation systems that can take us to space. And in the case of the United States, very soon, the dependency of the U.S. on Russia will come to an end. And that it will be manifested by the launch of either the Boeing CST-100 commercial crew transportation vehicle or the SpaceX Dragon. And then there are others behind that, like the New Shepard and made by Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, that will follow along soon after, I think. However, I can say the governments of the United States and Russia are aware of that threat to cooperation and cohesion. And I'm a member of a commission called the International Space Station Advisory Committee, which meets twice a year with our Russian counterparts. And there's a couple of astronauts on it, and I'm one of them. I'm the most junior person, actually. And we meet with them, and we've discussed the possibility of not having enough cooperation. And so the solution, and it's an artificial one, it's kind of a contrived one, is to insist that always each Soyuz will carry an American, and each American vehicle, whichever one of those commercial ones I mentioned goes, will carry a Russian. And so there's an intent to keep our crews, at least to some extent, trained on the other country's system. It doesn't mean that all crews will train on all the other vehicles, but that's the way we'll keep this going.
And what about keeping the space station itself going? And there's a lot of talk at the moment of how it gets extended beyond 2024, which is the date everyone's committed to.
Personally, I am very concerned about the end of the International Space Station. The formal date is 2024. Every engineer, every manager, every person who's worked on it, astronauts, cosmonauts, we all think that the space station is such an enormously difficult challenge, an achievement on the part of humanity, that it should continue. However, budget within each of those space agencies is limited, and it doesn't change much. And the desire to go back to the moon, to go to Mars. You've heard about an asteroid redirect mission, which was recently, again, cancelled by Trump's administration. These various projects compete for that money. And so for them to actually be able to say, we can keep supplying the International Space Station with crews and cargo, food and supplies for repair, it's hard for them to claim they can do it. In fact, they cannot. And so there are formal plans to deorbit the International Space Station in 2024. And the fuel is being launched year by year by Russia to fill up the tanks of the service module and the FGB to enable the space station to be deorbited in 2024 by a Russian progress vehicle. That is the current plan, and I think it's a bad plan. I think it's a massive waste of a fantastic resource. But I understand there is a very limited amount of money to keep it going. To keep it going at the level that it's at now, I think, is definitely not going to happen. But I believe, and I've always been a fan of commercial space, as commercial space starts to find a market, and it hasn't got a good market yet, but as it starts to find a market and develop it, I'm hoping, and it's purely hope, that commercial space could come up with a business plan that allows parts of the International Space Station to be maintained in space without sinking it into the Pacific Ocean.
Otherwise, it could see, in a way, in the same way that politically and historically you see the rise and fall of different empires on Earth, that maybe this is time now for the rise of the Chinese or the Indian Space Agency, probably China more than anybody else.
You bring up a very good point, and space is not the preserve of any one nation at all, and we've seen that in history, and certainly China is developing its space program very effectively. India's program is very interesting also. And Europe, you know, I think that we're here in Europe today in the Netherlands, and the question is, what does ESA think it should do with the International Space Station? I'm not actually hearing any noise from, when I say noise, comments from ESA as to what they think should be done. They know they have a limited budget too. They know they want to go where the Americans go, you know, to the moon or wherever. And so the tendency is to say, well, we'll just forget about what the end of the space station will be.
They're more concerned with the moon, actually, aren't they? Moon Village from Jan Werner.
Well, not just ESA. I would say all now that Trump has redirected NASA, even the United States now is going back to the moon first, and Mars is somewhere down the road. And that means all the countries are looking at the moon, India and China in particular. And just recently, in the last few days, NASA has signed an agreement. It's a low-level agreement, I would say, not at the president-to-president level. An agreement with Russia to study a lunar gateway, is what they're calling it. I've always thought of it as a lunar safe haven. And it would be based on some kind of combination of Russian and American modules as a core, and then I guess other countries would add on to it. And it would be a safe haven for vehicles independently, when I say countries independently going down to the moon or not, going around the moon or not, but at least they can use this waypoint, way station around the moon.
Are you saying that you can't have all these things? You can't have an ISS or some sort of space station around the Earth and a space station around the moon and exploration of the moon all at the same time? The decisions have to be made about one or the other. Or can you have them all in some way?
You know, I've had hopes dashed 1,000 times as to what I thought politics would do in space. You know, I thought I would have been on the moon by the time I was about 35 and probably on Mars by the time I was 45. And that's what I thought when I was finishing my PhD in Cambridge, which was, you know, I wasn't a fool, but I was certainly naive about politics. And I think that wisdom is not unfounded. So the answer to your question is there is not enough money within the government budgets to do all those things you just said. So how do you maintain some kind of space station as you do the others? And you have to come up with some very innovative ways of keeping it up in space. I personally believe I've actually created I've bought the domains for SaveTheSpaceStation.com. And I'm still giving NASA a chance to tell me how they're going to do it. But I think we're going to have to do some kind of crowdfunding or something like that.
You retired in 2013. How are you predominantly spending your time, obviously, apart from being a cheerleader for the space station?
Well, I actually, one of the things, you know, I started my career as a scientist in Cambridge doing physics and then a PhD in physics. And I've always been interested in programming, machine learning. My daughter's at Cambridge doing a PhD in engineering now. I love aviation so much. So I've actually diverted away from space a little bit. And my interests are in machine learning, applying artificial intelligence to making aircraft sensors. It's sort of like an Internet of Things, but it's kind of an artificial intelligence approach to measuring when an aircraft could go out of control, warning the pilot, preventing it. It's kind of smart machines. And I started off, though, in that direction, applying it to Richard Branson's Spaceship Two rocket motors with a colleague of mine testing them in the desert in Mojave. And to come up with ways of just spotting if the engine's going to blow up. And I've applied that now beyond to other systems.
That's fascinating. It's funny because Richard hasn't been to Mojave, and I was at Spaceport America only a few weeks ago in New Mexico to be on the runway to see where Virgin Galactic are going to land. Do you think they're going to get there within a couple of years?
Oh, I think a couple of years, yes. I'm just hoping they do the powered flight this year, but I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Would you go? Have you been invited? Are you going to go back into space?
I'm invited, but yeah, I'm out there, you know, in my shorts and t-shirt, and I'm just running wires and checking cables, and I'm a kind of a backup test firing manager in the blockhouse for their engine. They've basically moved on. They have a good engine now, I can say that, and they're about ready to. I think they're getting close to flying passengers. You know,
that's very exciting. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
British-born NASA astronaut Michael Foale. Well, that was interesting.
It was. I didn't expect him to be such a conservationist when it came to the space station.
Yeah, so this whole date of 2024, we're going to have to look up these URLs now, see if he's actually done anything with them. But, you know, crowdfunding, the idea, you know, crowdsourcing funding for the space station. I mean, there are quite a few private operators already on the space station, particularly NanoRacks, but you need a lot of money to keep that in orbit and keep supplying it as well.
But I can imagine, particularly in the States, there would be enough supporters of, let's face it, has been dominated by Russia and America. I know there's the European Space Agency involved and the Japanese and the Canadian Space Agency, etc. But when you think of the space station, you think of that partnership between Russia and America. And it, quite rightly, should be seen as a source of technological pride and aspiration, and why should it end, you know?
I think one of the problems is that the Americans have already moved on. Certainly the government's already moved on. When you've got a president with a limited attention span, it's all about the moon now.
It's all about the money.
And it's about the money in commercial space. But
it's about
the moon and Mars. That's the new narrative. So it's almost as if, well, we've done space station, let's go on to the moon.
Yeah, well, that's... As I said, that's the opportunity for the Chinese, I think, other countries to get up there, because the Chinese are putting their own space station up fairly soon, aren't they?
Yeah, so we're going to get a Chinese space station, the International Space Station maybe coming out of orbit, and a gap again with America before maybe they go on to the moon.
Not unless Michael gets his crowdfunding sorted out. Yeah, it's great news.
So SaveTheSpaceStation.com. This is Space Boffins Podcast. We're supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium. And next month, we have Apollo astronaut Al Warden, who is... I think he's my new favourite astronaut. Mm. I mean, I know I'm quite, you know, I kind of...
Fickle
about my astronauts, but he's very, very good.
Well, I've got a bit of a girl crush on Claudie Hanyere. I couldn't quite remember how to pronounce it. I know I pronounced it right the first one I introduced her, but a few minutes have gone by now and I can't remember, but she was charming and lovely and, I liked her. Sorry, Samantha, Christopher Retti. You're now number two, so I'm going to have to see you very soon so you can get back to number one.
Anyway, that's it for this month. We'll be back next month from the European Space Agency here in the Netherlands. Thanks for listening.